everyone. Welcome back to the Conservative Woman's Guide. I'm your host, Karen Lips. Today, I'm joined by Caroline Downey, education and multimedia reporter for National Review, editor-in-chief of the Conservator, and a visiting fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. You might recognize her from appearances on Fox News and Fox Business. She joins me this week for an episode on the Conservative Woman's Guide to Conservative Media. Now, Caroline, many young women are looking for an alternative to magazines such as Vogue, Cosmo, and Elle, which have been captured by the left. Just this election season, Cosmo ran an article headlined, "How to Capture the Hearts and Minds of Young Voters, a Guide for Dummies." It features seven Gen Z activists, only one of whom is a conservative. And for the conservative, the magazine selected a man. It's no wonder that conservative women are looking for something else. We want to get a firsthand account of what it's like working in conservative media and combating some of these leftist narratives pushed by mainstream media to young women. So welcome, Caroline, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I would love to begin by having you walk us through your career path. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, it's a long journey, and I attribute all of the little successes along the way to probably formative mentors, a combination of them, you know, the classes I took in college, and the honestly, my collection of connections that I was, you know, very intent on collecting from basically like a sophomore in college. So I went to Boston College, and there I studied economics and political science. So, I mean, those two disciplines are related to what I do today. But in reality, it's very difficult to jump from just having a bachelor's degree at any liberal arts college to journalism or journalism in the conservative movement, just, you know, like A to B. That's a big leap. So you really need to rely on all of the resources and support around you. So essentially what I did is I had to do this the old-fashioned way because, you know, and this is not a knock to my friends over at Hillsdale College. They all are like among the most brilliant people I know, and they were effectively shoo-ins into the conservative industry because they were effectively kind of primed for that since freshman year. And that's fantastic because the pipeline is extremely well developed for them and for a couple other small Christian colleges too. But if you go to a mainstream college like mine, you kind of need to, you know, get kind of, you know, put some elbow grease in and sort of dig to find people who will help you along the way. And so I ended up doing an internship at the Heritage Foundation my junior year of college. And I got that, you know, basically, I didn't even have any glowing recommendations at the time. I just joined campus groups, and that kind of demonstrated on my resume that I was, you know, very passionate about this movement, but I was also like actively involved, and I was a dissenter on campus, and that, you know, was like a green flag probably for them when they were, you know, hiring their intern class. And I joined whatever publication on campus there was. I needed to get my feet wet in writing. I needed to like just start writing something, even if it was elementary level, you know, for college, in my opinion. I always look back at old writing and I'm just like, oh, appalled at whatever I wrote back then, but I needed that early experience to, you know, get to the next leap pad and then so on. So, you know, I ended up at the Heritage Foundation, and unfortunately organizations like New, they were just starting as I was on my way out of Boston College. And my school doesn't have a great network of, let's call it, contrarian chapters. It never did. And it's because it's in Boston. It's a very progressive city.
But we did get a small but mighty chapter at Boston College.
Yeah. No.
Started, which is great. And they're still going.
Yes. And the women I know who started it, some of them ended up writing for the Conservator later, and they are fabulous in every way. And they did it the right way. I mean, I was simply involved in some organizations. They started it. And I mean, that's kind of like a winning formula for, I think, you know, getting into conservative ink is by doing that. Cause again, it shows, you know, just how far are you willing to go, to, you know, become part of this movement. So, all right.
And I know I haven't seen you since you attended our national conference years ago.
Yes, yes. And that was one of those, again, I'm talking about how my college education isolated was not necessarily sufficient to get me where I am today. I had to rely on those external organizations like NEW, any seminars there were. And at the time, my political affiliation, or rather my political persuasion, wasn't completely solidified yet. I knew it was conservative, but I had no idea that, like, there were factions and different sides of the spectrum, libertarian, populist, whatever. I didn't really know all that. And because frankly, now it's highly scrutinized in a way it wasn't really back then, which was only like 5-6 years ago. But I mean, I went to a new seminar in DC, and it was, I think, a couple days of, amazing panelists like Katie Pavlich, who's now also a contributor, a major, host at Fox, and she was giving her perspective, and all of that served as inspiration and motivation for me to keep going. And, I just kept like gleaning new information. And so I became a good listener, I would say, in those early stages, because I needed to figure out how everybody got here, because, I wasn't going to get it just from my school.
So did you intern at the Heritage Foundation during college or right after college?
During college.
During college. Okay. And then what was your first job? What was your first job after college?
So I took a detour because it was COVID and I had an econ major, and I was like, I got to give my parents some ROI on their investment here, some return on this college degree. So I went into finance. I did wealth management for a year because my whole family was in finance. And I was like, during that whole period, it was a tumultuous time in this country. As you remember, it was not only the pandemic, but it was the riots, the racial justice riots throughout the country. It was the 2020 election. And this confluence of events just kind of aided me constantly as I'm sitting there doing what I would consider, for me, it was somewhat mind-numbing finance. not everybody feels this way, but for me, my heart was always in another place. It was always in politics. Even though I knew it wouldn't make as much money, I probably would be taking a significant, pay cut from what finance was. I was just, it was like a vocational call, not to sound cliche, but I just couldn't stop thinking about, going back to doing something. And that didn't necessarily mean going back to Heritage to do a think tank job, but something like that. Journalism specifically, I had always been like, this is it. Like, journalism, I feel like this is the way to go.
But that's a good lesson, Caroline, that you can go into the private sector and, after graduation, and then still find your way into your passion, journalism.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody kind of, my family and friends, some people were suspicious at the time, but they knew who I was. They knew this was like in my lifeblood, basically, to talk and do politics as droning on as it could be and as exhausting as it could be for probably everyone else. They weren't surprised when I left finance and, I went to National Review, I would say on the ground floor. And this is the power of connections here. I got into NR because the editor at the time, his name is Charlie Cook. He's now a senior writer, but he used to be in an editing role. He was kind of presiding over the magazine at the time. He was the moderator of a debate that I did at the Heritage Foundation when I was an intern. So Heritage used to have kind of this inaugural debate. They chose two interns from the Cato Institute representing libertarianism and two interns from the Heritage Foundation representing conservatism. And they'd put them together and they'd be C-SPAN televised and they'd train them all summer. And it'd basically be like these two think tanks duking it out on TV. Which philosophy is superior? And I was chosen for that. And this is another thing. So my role at the Heritage Foundation was, it wasn't like I was doing policy or writing. I was placed in kind of a, let's call it like an HR adjacent department. That was my job at this internship. And, you'd think, okay, that, how are you going to get to the debate from working effectively in HR for Heritage? Not everything was a given this whole time, and I had to basically go kind of above and beyond to prove that I was worthy of the next accolade or the next opportunity.
Caroline, I like this story because it shows that working hard, standing out during your internship is not only just a good thing to do, but also it led directly to your career now.
Yeah, no, you got to go out on a limb. Like, you have to go out on a limb, even if it's uncomfortable. I mean, public speaking may not be your forte. For me, it I always kind of was like, this is the one skill set I want to master, because God knows I can't do computer science or sports or any of that other technical stuff. So this, you know, this is it. I like to talk, and I'm going to learn rhetoric, and I'm going to learn it well. And I was determined to do that. I did mock trial in college, and then debate, speech and debate in high school. So, you know, both of those things fed into one another. And then, yeah, Heritage was like, we're having tryouts, all the interns. You want to do it. And I think like there were 70 interns in our class, 30 tried out, and they picked two. And I was one of the ones they picked. And then that meant I got to do this debate, meet the Cato people, meet the editor of National Review. And he remained in my kind of connection book for 3 years or so after my senior year of college, after I did that weird finance tangent. And he was just always this person I kind of kept in touch with. And then when I made the big jump back like to journalism, which is what I am in now, I had him vouch for me effectively. I applied, you know, to NR, and I said, you might remember me. I mean, he knew me, but the hiring people didn't know me. I was like, I did this debate and he moderated, and I, you know, we're friends, and you know, he could speak maybe to some of my qualifications to be in National Review, given that he moderated this debate. And this was not some, you know, this was a very intellectual debate that I prepped for months. And so that is what enabled me to get in. And then from there, I've just been moving up again, because it's all up to you from that point on. It is all up to you where you go.
So you are an education reporter at National Review. A lot of our listeners are very interested in higher ed. I know you just wrote a story about the University of Florida and DEI. We had Sharice Trump from Speech First on earlier in this podcast season. Could you share one of your stories that you've written about higher education that you think our listeners might learn from?
Yes. Well, so I definitely cover education as my main beat, but that is a much broader umbrella than it used to be. So it does also encompass all of the different sides of education that we see now, not just K-12, but also higher ed reform. You could argue preschool daycare level, gender ideology, critical race theory, all the different sides, the messiness that education is now. I do cover that. So it's not just school choice anymore. And I mean, it's not that school choice is a very important, you know, frontier of coverage. It's just that it's not limited to that anymore. It's so much more. I mean, like you said, the DeSantis administration and effectively gutting the DEI departments, you know, as an effort to restore meritocracy to the state's universities and hopefully the country's universities. So I'd say the most pivotal education story for me that kind of further propelled me into this niche I'm in was right when critical race theory was becoming an issue. It was like two and a half years ago, and it was happening everywhere. And it was, I think the big focal point were the parental rights movement, more specifically the mom and dad school board candidates, like the average Joe soccer mom, hockey dads that were running for school board to basically preserve academic integrity in their schools, to get some accountability for COVID, all these different things. And maybe I'm getting the year mixed up, but in Connecticut, there was this kind of ragtag group of parents in Guilford, Connecticut. And I just took this as an opportunity to kind of put my flag in the sand on critical race theory in the Northeast. And again, like this wasn't as saturated as a topic as it is now. It was kind of just starting. And the editor-in-chief of NR said, you know, why don't you like look into Guilford and just do a series on this and just keep reporting what this parental group's kind of progress is. Like, are they winning hearts and minds? Are they winning Republicans? Are they winning independents? And that was extremely, you know, rewarding and fruitful. And then I ended up writing a very long piece for the print National Review, which is kind of a legacy product NR still has. The editor-in-chief asked me to write about this Guilford group of parents for the magazine, because it was an example of what was happening across the country. This group of parents that were so politically agnostic prior. These are parents that did not want to be dragged into this, but they felt compelled to because of what was happening to their kids. you know, what they were being taught indoctrination wise, and then just the COVID scandal of it all. And the Northeast is, it's a particularly a place, you know, having been gone to BC where my family's all from this area, it's, you're going to be a leper if you, you know, stick your neck out politically. And, but this had to do with their children, and, you know, they wanted to be heard at all costs. So, anyway, it was cool. It was a great creative writing experiment because I had to sort of paint the picture of, you know, Guilford is a quaint little town in the Northeast. It might remind you of Charlotte's Web. I mean, you really have to hook the reader early on with illustrative, like, illustration in order to kind of go in to zero in on this group of five parents that are kind of a microcosm of what is happening across the nation.
Are you optimistic, both in K-12 and higher ed? Do you think things are moving in the right direction?
I would say with higher ed, I think we've seen some positive developments with the, you know, Claudine Gay ouster, as well as the new scrutiny on DEI, largely because, unfortunately, I think October 7th precipitated that. And I think the old school Jewish liberals are now realizing that these are not dependable institutions. They are abandoning them and what they thought they were buying into, they are not getting. And so, like, you know, I think all of that is contributing to the, you know, like this new scrutiny of academia, and albeit the aggressive approach to exposing plagiarism and all that, that's new. I think that's, or it seems new, but I think it could be working. And I think sometimes that kind of aggressive journalism is necessary to prove to the people who are kind of apathetic about all this to realize, you know, like, actually this is like a rot. This is a rot that is ruining the quality of your tuition dollars. And so I think that is moving in a positive direction.
I want to now turn to another hat you wear, which is editor-in-chief of The Conservator. Could you share the founding story of that online magazine? And then also, what are some of your challenges now in your current role?
Yeah, so that is my passion project on the side that's now almost 3 years in the making. So I didn't technically found it. I run this magazine called The Conservator with three other girls, two of whom co-founded it during college. One of them went to UC Berkeley, a hotbed of rabid progressivism, and the other one went to SMU, which is a much more sympathetic environment if you think like us. And the two of them had some background in fashion. I think like Alice and Olivia, even Vogue at one point, I think they'd all kind of had little stints within fashion. And both of them were also very politically plugged in. And it was kind of it was really 2020. 2020 is what kind of like sent them down this path, because it was just, especially on the UC Berkeley, her name is Jamie Chandler Franklin, on her campus, it was just wild activity, very just, you know, like unrest and what she was seeing and some of the protests and whatever tumult was happening across the country. That was just kind of a wake-up call, and the Conservator launched really right during that period, which was a hard time to launch.
So then when did you get involved?
I got involved only a couple months later. So I'm not technically a co-founder, but so our Instagram following is now at like 55,000 followers. And so, you know, we have a significant audience now. But back then, I think there were like 100 followers. So I joined the Conservator at about 100 followers. So, you know, got in very early and, you know, quickly became editor.
And what's your age demographic? Who would you say is your core audience?
It's actually very mixed. It's, I mean, overwhelmingly women, but there's I think it's like 10% men. And the women are, I mean, anywhere from like young preteen to college age to moms to honestly like kind of retired age women. It's really all of them, which is why we try to cater in our content to all those different groups. What's most interesting to me, demographically speaking, like if you look at our data, it's that a lot, I mean, I would argue a majority, although I have to like break this down, majority of our followers don't follow any other political accounts. They don't follow like the Daily Wire. They don't follow any other political accounts. We are it. which what leads me to believe that there are normal, kind of politically agnostic women out there who have a set of values that they would like to see them represented in their fashion and lifestyle content, but they're not looking for some sort of preachy, screechy, you know, doomer political content. They want something uplifting and inspiring and frankly, aesthetically pleasing. But this, we are their first introduction to conservative thought, essentially. That's what their Instagram metrics would like tell me, or their profile. The profile tells me. So I say that is like a very important mandate at the Conservator to cater to those kind of independent thinking women that are, you know, they're not super, they don't read the Wall Street Journal every day, and maybe they should, but we need to keep their attention and then hopefully like kind of convert them, you know, in a gentle way or, you know, over time. So, and that I think also is a testament to how important aesthetics really are, because I think plenty of conservative brands have tried to be stylish, and what they end, you know, I think it, they struggle because you can't mimic what our opponents are doing from 10 years ago. Like, we can't be Vogue from 10 years ago. We can't be considered tired millennial. We have to be cutting edge. And so, you know, our creative director is very talented at this. She is a genius at Instagram curation, graphic design. I mean, and I, like I said, style, like fashion itself, the edits that they put together are something that you would probably see in Vogue. And we're very proud of that fact. And I think that's half the reason we've appealed to so many women thus far. And then we can kind of feed them prose and arguments about, you know, countercultural things, and, you know, it hopefully resonates, but there has to be a gateway, and the gateway has to be, I think, visual, and it has to be inspiring, but also aspirational. I mean, there's a couple other like fashion magazines in this movement or whatever, and, you know, I think they try to represent women of different, you know, socioeconomic classes, and they're not necessarily putting, you know, designer brands like on the website, but we try to do a mix because we think that fashion is inherently aspirational, and you know, we try to do some budget stuff, but also, I mean, yeah, like we will show designers. So anyway, that's the challenge we have right now. I would say the biggest challenge is probably like a combination of not enough capacity, because we almost like grew too fast for us to manage.
One of the things New does, and a purpose it serves, is serving as an entry point for young women into the conservative movement. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about the Conservator doing that as well from a cultural perspective. So I want to ask you a cultural question. We've seen some discussions of a cultural shift now taking place among young women, especially thanks to people like Sophia Richie getting married young and starting a family, and even Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's relationship. Do you think there is some type of cultural shift happening among young women and what their aspirations are?
I do. I think there is some sort of reset happening, although that is harder. And I say this word loosely, but to deprogram a lot of women who may have been fed a package of lies or misleading information about how their life is supposed to look like. And it takes a long time sometimes to sort of show them an alternative lifestyle. And I'm referring more to the corporate burnout that I've seen among girls of my generation. They went to a liberal arts college, they got a great degree, and they went right into the kind of the corporate machine, sort of, you know, absurdly long hours, you know, whether it's finance or another industry. And I think they, again, like most women are, we all have industrious capacity, and we want to use our talents and our gifts in the workplace, but maybe also in a family setting. But, you know, I think there is kind of a balance that we have to strike. And this is, you know, I'm not the first woman to try to prescribe some work-life balance as like this groundbreaking new thing. But yeah, I would say what Sophia Richie popularized was a lifestyle that is, I mean, granted, it glamorizes domesticity, and not every single woman is, you know, jumping to embrace domesticity or the domestic goddess life right off the bat. Like I said, they have degrees and they, you know, they have a skill set they want to apply in the working world, or at least try it. But, you know, you have to keep in mind that some of these industries, or rather the demanding hours, can kind of corrode your soul after a while as a woman. It can really drain you and exhaust you and leave you feeling not fulfilled, not rewarded, but rather burned out and kind of demoralized. So I think Sophia Richie, yes, I mean, she's ushering in this era of not just quiet luxury on the fashion side, but I would say finding your spouse, having children early on, and dedicating your young life to that. I think she's also bringing back modesty, like a degree of, like I said, quiet luxury also kind of implies modest dressing, and just not in kind of a, again, preachy, lecturing, you know, you should really be modest type of way, but in a, like, this is beautiful, and this is so classy, and so refined, and so elegant. And, I mean, it's not like she was doing anything, like, super new. It's just that I think people forgot, a lot of women forgot how fabulous this could be. And so, I mean, everybody was mimicking her style. I mean, all the different types of clothes she was wearing. I saw it all around New York City. So, you know, that's kind of interesting how one influencer who is not even affiliated with the right wing at all could, and I think it was Evie Magazine that wrote this argument. One, you know, ex superstar formerly dated one of the Kardashian members of the family, you know, one of the Kardashian people. How could she be doing more for like a revival of traditionalism than any right-wing pundit? So, but again, I think that's because the gateway was aesthetics, and her aesthetics were supreme. They were extremely, you know, I don't know, just refined. And it was something that a lot of women wanted to emulate, even if they, you know, they don't have the Sophia Richie fortune, and they didn't marry some tech multimillionaire or whatever it is. You know, they wanted to try to mimic that because it, you know, it was very, it's something that again, glamorizes like the good and the beautiful. So yeah, I would say we're seeing a shift. Like I said, it's deeply rooted though, like deeply rooted, like there's a deeply rooted consciousness, I think, in a lot of women that they're like, I don't want to waste my potential on family right off the bat. Like, or that might be something, kind of the voice in their ear, because it's been a voice in my ear, which is like, how can I have both? But I think the remote revolution has been very helpful for women, because now, you know, women can lean into their, the creative talents more than they could before, while balancing home life. So you can, you know, from the comfort of your home, you can work on your laptop and not have to report to a boss in Manhattan after an hour commute where you drop your kid off of daycare along the way. And, you know, plenty of women make that work. And, you know, it, again, we're in the modern era. It's never been easier for a woman to make these things work. So that's a blessing. But yeah, I would say just being able to be at home on your computer, you know, with children, I feel like that makes a huge difference.
I very much appreciate remote work, Caroline.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference. I want to go back to your point about, you're talking about culture and how culture matters. What do you think conservatives can do to influence culture more effectively?
I think it starts at the micro level for sure. I think a lot of times conservatives get really caught up at the national, federal, you know, circumstances and charades, and just, it's a circus. It's a constant circus. And I think it's really easy to get addicted. It's almost like dopamine hits of outrage, but you are left feeling hopeless. And I think some part of our media structure feeds this like beast of, you know, like outrage doomer for outrage sake, but then it's a dead end. Like you have nowhere to channel your energy, like nowhere to channel your grievance, but there is a place where you can channel, you know, and I wouldn't call it grievance, but there's a place where you can feed, you know, your values in a positive, or rather you can move like your values into. And I think that's like in your own community with your, if you don't have a family, you're not building one of your own right now, you can definitely do this with your siblings and your parents. And I mean, the most impact you can have counterculturally is at the local level. Absolutely. Because, I mean, to some extent, you could argue that national politics is just going to keep on steamrolling, whether you like it or not. That's not to say we don't matter. We do elect our representatives. And of course, we the people have an impact. But it's not going to be as rewarding and probably as impactful as I would say calling your mom like more often, or visiting, you know, or being a good aunt to maybe a sibling who just had a baby or something, or a friend who had a baby and maybe, you know, you're helping them with the maternity journey or whatever it is. I think you can do a lot culturally within your own community.
That's a message we share with a lot of our college chapters is, you know, lead on your campus, lead in your local community. You can make such a difference. Right. Carolyn, I want to ask you about advice. What piece of advice would you give to your college age self?
My college age self, I would say, don't worry about not moving fast enough, or don't worry about feeling behind, because like as the saying goes, you know, the things that you prayed for back then, they're happening right now, and that's happened at a meteoric pace in the last 3 years. The things that I never thought possible are now happening in my career and life. And so I would tell myself to chill out, honestly, just to chill out, because it'll happen before you know it. And then you'll be, you know, wishing you hadn't stressed out so much in the past and maybe kind of ruined some really special moments in your youth by, you know, kind of fretting. You know, fretting is wasteful. Like the time is the only finite resource we have. And That's one piece of advice. I think the other piece of advice is, and this did pay dividends like throughout my early career, and I already mentioned this, but make as many connections as possible, but make them like authentic. You know, there's some people you can tell they're like serial networkers, and all they do is just collect names and business cards, and you know, that's just they're, you could tell that they are climbing. They are climbers. And, you know, okay, fine. But you could also just do it organically. You could just, you know, make friends and befriend people. And then, you know, later down the road, maybe they would vouch for you in an interview. Or, you know, maybe they would put in a word of rec. I think that's, you know, much more normal and natural and fun. So, yeah, that's what I would say. But go to every networking event for sure. I would say, and here's the other thing. I would say go to every social event. While you're young and have few obligations, go to every party, every networking event, every seminar, like whatever you can. And I have like chronic FOMO, so it's hard for me to miss these things anyway. I mean, I live in New York City and I'm constantly like training back to DC, because if there's an event and I'm like, no, I got to go to this event. Like, you know, because I don't know what I'm missing. I got to go. And again, I do that with kind of like, I'm so invigorated by the career path I've chosen that I want to do everything in it. And hopefully all girls that are, you know, followers of New will find that for themselves, you know, something that makes them want to get up in the morning, that makes them want to put themselves out there and, you know, be involved, like extremely involved. And yeah, go to every single function, go to every function. So yeah, that's my advice. That I did correctly, I think, in college.
Caroline, it was great to have you on the Conservative Woman's Guide to discuss how you got involved in conservative media. Listeners, make sure you subscribe to the Conservative Woman's Guide wherever you get your podcasts so that new episodes automatically download. Leave a 5-star review and share this episode with your friends. We'll see you next week.